Hey, listeners. I'm Karen Riley Jeffers, NCSM's Eastern 2 Director. Welcome to our series, Learning with Leaders, Everyone Belongs in Mathematics. Thank you for joining me and my co-host, Abel Maestas, the host of Teaching That Counts, as we talk with both leaders and influencers about their math journeys and contributions. Today, we will hear from our special guests about their inspiration, perceptions, and insights regarding instructional decisions that make the mathematics space welcoming and engaging to all. Listen and learn about how beliefs, practices, and policies must continue to advance to ensure that each and every person feels a sense of belonging in mathematics.
Well, welcome everybody to this month's episode of the NCSM Learning with Leaders, Everyone Belongs in Mathematics podcast. I am one of your hosts, Abel Maestas, and
Karen Riley Jeffers.
And we are welcoming everybody to our podcast, to this podcast this month. And we just want to do a shout out to all of our listeners. And we got some great news this last month, didn't we, Karen?
We did. Exciting news.
It was super exciting. So I opened my Facebook feed and NCSM post, congratulations. We got, I think we were ranked number 5 in educational leadership podcast by the website FeedSpot that does a lot of ranking of podcasts. Yeah, I know, right? And so that was super exciting to see that. And I started sharing it with everyone and I was like, man, this is amazing.
Yep. And then we ended up with another one by Million Podcast. And we ended up being number 6 for a best math teacher podcast.
Best math teacher podcast. Yes. And so great. Big, big thanks to all of our listeners for listening to our podcast and helping, you know, this is our first season as the host and helping us grow. And we've had such great guests on our podcast that I send out as much as I can on my own social media about just listen. I've learned so much. This is like my best PD for my own growth as a math educator. But I think so many math teachers, so many educational leaders, as we see in our rank in these rankings, can learn so much from listening to this podcast. So we want to thank all of our listeners. We want to thank all of our guests that have made this podcast such a great podcast to be part of.
Yes. I would say, as I'm just echoing Abel, that I've learned so much. I always learn so much. And one thing that I think is good for our listeners to know is how intentional we are about who we select and how we're selecting. Because it's really important to us that we remain true to our theme of everyone belongs here. So we're thinking about all the voices and spaces where we don't typically hear, and bringing them into this space to uplift them and to learn and grow as leaders ourselves and to share with everyone else.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And as we talk about our guests that we meet often and we talk about who we want to be on our on the podcast, so we can listen, we can have conversations around belonging, that we really had taken time to think about what our theme was this season. And so with that being said, we are excited to welcome our guests this month, and we'd like to welcome Joshua Thurby to our podcast. Welcome, Joshua.
Thank you. It's really great to be here. And those are great statistics and very well deserved. That's amazing.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. So a little bit about Josh, so the listeners know. Josh is a math methods instructor at the University of Pennsylvania and a senior program officer for teacher development at the Knowles Teacher Initiative, where he works with beginning high school math and science teachers to improve math and science education in the U.S. His work in education spans more than 20 years, where he's worked as a math and science teacher, a math and science methods course instructor, and a coach for early career math and science teachers. His areas of interest, which we're going to talk about today, include math education, social justice, equity, teacher education, and LGBTQ issues. So again, we want to thank Josh for coming on to our podcast.
I'm so grateful. And I appreciate the space you've created here, especially like to talk about belonging and the way you've been so intentional with your guests. Even as a listener, like I've appreciated and seen that intention happening. And it's really nice to be a part of it.
Thank you. And I'm super duper excited that you're here. And even though you were just introduced, would you share some of your journey in education that has led you to your current work?
Absolutely. And this might come across as a long meandering story, but I swear like it all connects. So I started my journey at a traditional teacher's college that happened to be a conservative Christian college. And I happened at that time in my life to be a conservative Christian. So I wanted to be a physics teacher. I ended up getting also a math degree because I thought that would make me marketable. And turns out I fell in love with teaching math along the way. But my first job was at an independent school in Denver, Colorado. And I went to school in Chicago. I spent most of my life in Chicago. And so that first experience I was teaching, and you know, it's an independent school. I taught all the 6 through 8 math and science classes and a few English classes and a cooking class, as one does in a school when you're a beginning teacher. And I didn't make a lot of money. And so I also was tutoring every day after school. I also worked at Starbucks. So as you can imagine, that was unsustainable. And I quit teaching after 2 years. And the university they had gone to had reached out asking if I would come back and be a recruiter for new students. And they offered to pay me to move back, and they offered me a way higher salary than I was making. And in, you know, those 2 years of working in that independent school, I realized, yeah, I needed to come out, and I needed to figure out like who Josh was as an adult, and then also figure out who Josh was as a teacher. And so it felt kind of safe to do that in a non-teaching space, you know? So I was like, okay, I'll take this job. I'll go back to Chicago. I didn't know a soul in Denver. I just moved there because it was a pretty city. So then to move back to Chicago where I had a support network, it felt like a good time to like, okay, let's explore who Josh really is. And so I took this job. I came out to just my friends and my family, not at all to my coworkers. Working at a Christian university. And after a year of working there, the dean called me into his office to say that I was no longer welcome there because I was gay. And as long as I kept my private life private, they would keep me, but they didn't really see that happening. And so they encouraged me to find employment elsewhere. And to be clear, I in no way was like out. I was like very, very privately out. And another friend of mine from college was looking for jobs as well. And he was like, could you help me write my resume? And would you help me go to this job? He didn't want to go to a job fair alone. And so I was like, yeah, I'll work on my resume too. And I'll go with you to this job fair. And I went and I only looked at schools who had a written clause that said they supported gay teachers. And I think it was 2 schools that had that at that time. And I applied to one of them and I got hired because they were smart. And so that really set me on the road to being an advocate and an activist of like, okay, this Josh as a person and Josh as a teacher needs to go in this one direction. You know, like this is a road I need to go down. And so right away at that job, I like quickly tried to develop to be a really good teacher, obviously. And I started a gay straight alliance at that school with a really wonderful straight ally teacher. I got very involved in the union so that I continued to be protected. So again, it really like developed my skills in terms of advocacy and activism. And then I went from there and got a job with the University of Chicago. They were starting a charter high school on the south side of Chicago. And so I got to work at the beginning stages of that And during this time, I also got my master's in educational leadership. I became the department chair at that school in Chicago. I became an instructional coach and, again, started a Gay Straight Alliance. I, you know, again, this like theme of like activism and advocacy, especially for queer students. And eventually I got to work part-time at the University of Chicago, as well as at this high school. So my classroom kind of became like a lab space for some of the stuff we were doing at the university. And I was working in their urban teacher education program. So they had had a K through six teacher program, but then they finally started a secondary program and only for math and biology. So I got to work there. So then I started teaching courses in their program on identity and methods courses. And then that program also gave their graduates 3 years of coaching. And so then I got to coach their teachers. And so it was really at that point that I started to do a lot of personal work, much deeper personal work around my own identity. So because I was teaching this course on identity with this really amazing team of other instructors, I started learning a lot about my own identity. It was the first time I joined a white affinity group, learning about my own whiteness. I started a queer affinity group to learn more about my own queerness and, again, like how the world sees me, how I see the world, and how that all interacts and how that affects teaching and learning in my classrooms. And eventually the university shut down the secondary ed program, and but because they had guaranteed 3 years of coaching to their graduates, I still had a job for three more years. So I had 3 years buffer to figure things out. And the Knowles Teacher Initiative has existed for over 20 years. So existed at that time. And we were funneling a lot of our teachers into that fellowship because we knew the Knowles Fellowship provided more years of coaching and support than the 3 years we could. And so we knew beginning teachers needed support. And so we kept pushing them into the fellowship. And I happened to be coaching one of my teachers from the University of Chicago. And we were talking about how I was losing my job. And she said, you know, Knowles is looking for somebody. And so I applied at Knowles, and then I've been there for the past 9 years. And so at Knowles, I get to work with beginning high school math and science teachers from across the country in their fellowship, where our goal is to transform math and science education in the U.S. And the way we do that is by accelerating the development of teacher leaders at the beginning of their career. So, yeah, that's been my trajectory. And then also some like just important mile markers in that story.
One of the things that is really resonating with me is the introspection that took place, where you said that you were exploring yourself, but not just like who you are, but also taking the time to consider how others see you and how that's impacting the classroom. But then as you shifted, you used whatever platform and level you were on to begin to carve spaces for others. How easy or difficult was that?
I so appreciate that you like understood that in that story. That is like for sure. And like looking now retrospectively at my career, I understand that I think my motivations for becoming a teacher really were around the idea that I never had the teacher I needed. And so I was becoming that teacher. And then when I became a teacher, the support did not exist for the type of teacher I was. And so then I learned I needed to create that space too. And so, but first I needed to create the space for the students, figure some things out about myself and about my career and about my position. And then I needed to create that space for teachers. And yeah, I mean, that's been, I grew up in the 90s. I was in high school and college in the 90s. And so it was just a different world back then. There were no students that were out when I was in high school or in college. I knew of other gay teachers when I was teaching, but not a single one of them was out. And so even the two schools where I started the GSA, it was just me, you know? And so the having support of other queer teachers at a time when like I really needed it just didn't exist because of the era I lived in, you know? But it meant I could start creating those spaces. And so I don't think it was really intentional, you know? Like looking back at it now, it seems super intentional. I realized that's where this was all headed. Josh was wise all along the way and he didn't know it. But yeah, and I think I'm just very grateful for all the steps along the way where like, yeah, I'm so grateful I got to be invited to teach that course on identity with this really powerful team of other instructors where I got to learn about what it means to be a queer teacher and the type of teacher that I needed, the type of colleague that I needed. So yeah, I think I was very lucky to be alongside some really powerful, wonderful people that had the patience to help me along the way when I needed a lot of patience. And yeah, now I'm in a space where I can now start, you know, creating those spaces for others. And I think that's been like the nice realization at this point in my career and in my life that, oh yeah, I needed that teacher. I needed that support. And now I've done that. I've become that teacher. I've become the person to be able to support those teachers. So I'm like, very proud of that.
Nice.
Yeah. So one thing that some people know out there that listen to this podcast is I'm a school board member in another district. So I'm a dad, a teacher, a math teacher, and also a board member in another district. And we've had, I've seen where, I'm not going to say where things are going, but I've seen and I've heard how things are happening right now in our, in our bigger government, but also as things get smaller into smaller spaces and smaller governments. And I just feel, I guess this is personally, but I feel that it seems to me like LGBTQ plus students are being systematically targeted in current policy. And it's not just policy that we see at the national level, but also in the local level in some of our districts here in California. And as I listen to what's happening in other districts and what I try to make sure doesn't happen in my own district, right, as a school board member. But I have students that I feel like, man, I feel like some of these policies are targeting them in a very negative way. And I know that really hasn't reached, I don't see it having reached mathematics education, but it has. Like I see it has and it hasn't. And I know that you're a big advocate for LGBTQ plus issues, especially those for our students. It seems to me as educators, as leaders, as teachers in the classroom, that we want to bring spaces of belonging for all of our students, especially those LGBTQ plus students that are kind of being, like I said, are being targeted. How do we do that? How do we continue to create those spaces of belonging when it seems to me like all these policies are working against us in doing that? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, as like a student, again, growing up in the 90s, I was not out, but was for sure very feminine, very like gay presenting. So got bullied and teased a lot for being myself. And, you know, even in math class, as you can imagine, I was brilliant as a child. I did really well in school. I understood how to play the game. And frankly, you know, I understood how to also play the game that being queer in this society did not work. And so my brain had to become very fluent in changing who I was at all moments. Like I could not ever be Josh. And in math class, at least, my thinking was for sure very valued. I am a creative problem solver. I can go on and on about my academic abilities. But what's interesting is that though teachers really did value my brain, and I am very grateful that I have amazing teachers all along the way, I still had teachers that said, like, maybe just don't talk so much so you don't get bullied. You know, maybe just sit on your hands when you share so I'm not doing all this gesturing. Their intentions were there. You know, like, they didn't want me hurt or bullied or targeted. And they did like my ideas. They just didn't like the way they were presented. And so though my, like, ideas belonged, Josh for sure didn't. And to the point that, like, Josh didn't even belong in his own brain. You know, like, I didn't come out till I was 24. So my brain for 24 years was really well practiced at saying, like, you don't belong this way. You know, your religion has told you you're an abomination. You know, society has told you you're choosing to be this way and you should choose a different life. So, and I had no examples of anyone around me, like, doing it correctly. And so even in my own brain, I didn't belong. Like, I needed to be a new and different person, or I needed to, like, disappear. Like, to me, those are the only options. And I think for a lot of queer folks, those are the only options when that's the society you grow up in. But then to understand that, A, society was wrong about that. So, sidebar, I think when, you know, you have, like, an oppressed identity, a targeted identity, it is an identity that provides you with some superpowers at a really early stage in life because you see through the lies of society. And so I learned really quickly, oh, society is really wrong about this. So they're probably wrong about a lot of things. And so, like, the lenses were taken off of, like, oh, I started to see the world for what it was. Way quicker than I think my peers did, you know, because I had to operate and survive in this world that was not designed for me. So in a way, it was like a huge gift of, like, okay, all of this is a big lie. This is all a big sham. Like, you're wrong about so many things, not just about me. And so for me to, like, finally, like, flourish and, you know, not just be tolerated anymore, but rather to be celebrated, really meant that I had to belong in my own brain. Like, I had to undo a lot of, like, programmed homophobia that I just, you know, for 24 years had been accepting. Like, this is, oh yeah, this is the way the world works, and I should just accept this. And so, I needed that assistance. It would have been great if a teacher had been able to assist me in that way. Which is, I also do a lot of work in mindfulness now. And I think a lot of that, again, for me, it was like, oh, had an adult told me at a young age, you're in charge of your brain. You're in charge of the thoughts you're having. You're in charge of whether you respond or react to those thoughts and those feelings. Like, no one really explained that to me. And now I'm like, oh, wait, again, more superpowers were emerging as I was, like, really leaning into my queer identity. And so I think, like, once I, like, found belonging in my own brain, and also more sidebars, just, like, imagine me as, like, a gay little kid in a math class, especially, like, if I was ever given, like, a group work problem or being told to go to the board, any time where I'm, like, spotlight is on me. My working memory is full of perform in this way, speak in this way, act in this way. My working memory has no room for how do I solve this problem? How do I, like, mathematically engage with this concept? My working memory is full of this performance on how to be a 16-year-old boy in America rather than a problem solver of mathematics. And so again, like, all my teachers were really wonderful and well-intentioned. I am now grateful that I know how to clear that working memory and stop those thoughts of performance, of I should be different, I should be more masculine, I should be quicker at this, I should be smarter, I should be a different being, and better at moving those away and then able to think about like mathematics. And so like for me, belonging really was about learning my own brain, learning how to control that, and learning that I belong in this brain, I belong in this body, and this body belongs on this earth. And that was a massive act of resistance in a society that was saying none of those things are true, you know? In this day and age, I think things are way different, and I'm very grateful for that. But it did feel like a very like lonely road in the beginning. And so I think now, as we're thinking about like creating these spaces for students and for teachers, quite frankly, an act of resistance is queer joy is a massive act of resistance. So I was sharing earlier, my Knowles Teacher Initiative just had our big summer conference, our big annual conference this past week, where we have five cohorts of fellows at any given time, and we bring all of them together to one location. And when I first started at Knowles 9 years ago, I made it a personal. So again, there was that moment in time where I became like more of an advocate and more of an activist. So I've realized in my career, I have to be the squeaky wheel so that others don't get that burden. When I came to Knowles, I knew like identity needed to be part of the curriculum and that queer teachers needed to be supported. And so from day one, I made that like just part of who I was at Knowles. Like, oh no, Josh just does these things. And so therefore these things will be done at Knowles. And Knowles has been really wonderful and acquiesced. And so my very first summer conference at Knowles, I had a queer teacher group that formed. We call ourselves the Cuties, Cuties. And I invited them, to connect just as queer educators. And there were four of us that very first year. And this year we had 46.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's just like that group is what brings those teachers joy. And we, in this most recent meeting, we were doing like a connector. And one of the questions was, what do you hope for from your queer colleagues at school? And every fellow that I talked to in my little group said, this space, I want this space at my school. And there's nothing necessarily magical about the space we created other than they are allowed to be themselves, like just authentically, easily themselves. And so I think that's what is needed. Like, I think having a space where queer students in a time of a lot of oppression and targeted legislation can experience queer joy in the face of that and say like, no, I'm going to live my authentic self and you all need to change. Because the message has been the other way around for so long. So like, I think the idea of are there role models for students? Are there role models for your, even for other colleagues? Are there spaces where queer students or queer colleagues are able to just talk to one another about anything? Not even about education. Like, can they just exist together in a space that feels safe and comfortable and joyous? Because that's really rare, especially right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that answered your question.
You did answer my
question. Oh yeah, you did, definitely.
And then you also tapped into another question that we had as well. So I was actually just, since you started talking about mindfulness, I was wondering if you could go in a little bit more about how this contributes to, and you talked about it, but a little bit more about how it's contributed to, how it contributes to a space of belonging and building, creating those spaces of belonging.
Yeah, I think like mindfulness and math to me just makes like perfect sense. The idea of us being allowed the time and resources to really think about our thinking and to become fully present in a moment. And to know that, again, like we're in charge of that. We have the remote control in our hands. And as thoughts go by, we can say like, skip, 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 and, you know, play. This is the thought I want to have. And we know that, like, just as related to math education, like even the example I gave earlier, that could be true for any student. You give any student, any teacher, a math task. There's a lot of negative self-talk that could occur before the math thinking even happens. And, you know, we've all experienced students with math anxiety where just being presented with a lot of text or a lot of data, or there's so much that then the brain gets overwhelmed. And to be able to have resources and practices that allow your brain to say, like, okay, yes, all of this is here, and I'm going to focus on this right now. To be able to, like, clear the working memory so that your brain can do math. And so, yeah, I've incorporated it a lot in my own teaching as I teach my math methods and as I teach with the fellows. And I think what I've found is, like, not only does it help with doing math and doing science, but also just helps in life. And again, and it helps in some of those identity ways as well, that, like, I know still to this day, you know, imposter syndrome exists for all of us where it shouldn't exist, and it doesn't exist for those where it should. So many people in life, I wish they were experiencing imposter syndrome. Are you sure you should be doing this? I won't give any examples, but I think we can all imagine at least one right now. But in all of that, I think this mindfulness has just helped me realize I have control of that, of those thoughts in my brain. I get to say skip, and I also get to say, like, what I want to focus on and what I want to respond to rather than what I want to react to. And, you know, and as a teacher, my God, like, there's a million things that happen in a day that I reacted to that I wish I had responded to, that I wish I had taken a moment, taken a breath, and bet a better version of myself for the student in front of me rather than a reactionary version of myself who then I apologize for later, you know? And so I think, like, the mindfulness has helped me, at least, be the better person in the moment that I, like, want to be, rather than the person in the moment that my brain is reacting to be without any conscious thought from Josh himself.
Yeah, that about reaction and response. I know that many teachers kind of struggle. I do this all the time, right? Something comes up in class and you've reacted or you've done something to address a situation. And then you spend the next 2 days thinking about it at night. I'm like, oh, what if I did this? I should have done that. I should have done this. I should have done that. How do you work with teachers in getting them to start thinking about that mindfulness beforehand, so we're not sitting there going, oh man, I did this, I did that.
Well, so first, like, the experience that you're describing there, Abel, is the experience, like, we all have that, like, later on, we start shooting on ourselves. I should have done this. I should have done that. I should have been better. I should have, you know, and shooting on ourselves is never a good idea. But as soon as, like, that happens, even there, you can get into this, like, negative mindset of, like, why can't I be the teacher I want to be? The fact that you're, like, having those thoughts means you are the teacher you want to be. If you hadn't been having those thoughts, if you weren't suddenly thinking, oh, I could have done that better, that's not a great teacher. Because you are reflecting and you are having that moment. And though that moment, so my advice in those moments is, like, oh, I'm reflecting, I'm growing. I didn't do the right thing. I can do the right thing next time. Like, there's the learning. And now I can stop that reel of shoulding, you know? And then what I do for my teachers is try and just create moments where I create, like, false high stakes moments for them, where I know their working memory is going to be full really quickly. So I'll, none of my future students are going to listen to this anyway, so I'll say one of my beginning activities is I give them 3 minutes to, and I teach, you know, all high school teachers. So I give them a sixth grade problem, 1/2 / 3/4. We all know the answer. That I don't want the answer. I just want to know, why does the algorithm work? Give me one real life example of 1/2 / 3/4 and give me at least one representation of what 1/2 / 3/4 looks like. This is a sixth grade standard. You're all high school teachers. You all have degrees in mathematics. You should be able to do this in about 3 minutes. I'm going to pick one of you at random to present to the rest of us in 3 minutes, and we will do this problem. So I've created this false high stakes environment of like, oh gosh, I should know that. He's told me I should know this. He's told me this is easy. And they're surrounded by a lot of other, you know, very impressive teachers. So then they're like, everybody else knows how to do this and I don't. A lot of times when I do this task, tears do emerge from my student. You know, it is just like this high stakes thing. And then when it comes for me to like pull the card, then I just stop everything. I put up an emotion wheel. I'm like, what are the emotions we're feeling right now? How is your body communicating those emotions to you? Like, what is happening physically to you right now to let you know you are in fight or flight mode? And so then we just start identifying, okay, well, because now it's a safe space. Now they're not being called up in front of the class. So now we are like in a way where we can kind of workshop things. And then they start identifying like, oh yeah, these feelings, this pit in my stomach, the way I'm sweating so much, the way my throat is tightening. Yeah, I've experienced this in front of students. I've experienced this in emotional distress. I've experienced this on a roller coaster. I've experienced this before. My body's informing me I'm not ready for what's about to come. I'm scared for what's about to come. I'm excited for what's about to... So your body's warning you, giving you some signals. And we're often just like ignoring it because we're like, quick, do this problem. He told me to do this problem, rather than like, oh, hey, my body's saying something here. My mind is saying something here. Let me take a breath. Let me figure out where I am, where I want to be, and how do I get to be that person? And the thing is, like, even just like taking that breath, taking that moment and acknowledging all those emotions. Oh yeah, I am feeling really scared right now. That makes sense. I'm nervous right now. That makes sense. And the thing is, all of us as teachers are really good at saying these things to a student. You're nervous right now? That's normal. We all get nervous. Like, we're so good at coaching students and showing love and compassion and grace to students. But when the mirror is held to us in a stressful moment, at least for myself, I am not gracious. I am not compassionate. I am not loving. I am shooting all over myself. You should be faster. You should know how to do this. And so then when we can like quickly shift the perspective and say like, you know, treat yourself as little Josh. He deserves tons of love and compassion and grace. And the person working, you know, we're working in a partnership on a math task. They also deserve a ton of compassion and love and grace. And so then we just kind of practice it in these like safer places in my class. And then they, you know, they experience life every day as it is. Then they start practicing these things in life. So yeah, I try and create these like false high stakes moments so that we can really get the visceral feeling and then practice what it's like to get out of that feeling and to get back to like a steady state.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because, and I may have mentioned this on the podcast, it's really interesting and ironic that I'm co-hosting a podcast because I was the child who didn't speak. And I've began to lead with that. So that others know. And I'm also a processor. So as a processor, I'm a quiet person. I'm a processor. I'm an introvert. Like, I'm all the quiet things, you know? And often fear will take over my working memory when I am in front of people. And there has been a couple of times where my mind has gone completely blank. From just the anxiety. Sometimes it's the anxiety that others put on you because of the demands that you want to meet, or it's the anxiety that you just put on yourself because of the expectations that you put on yourself. And I was a part of a committee and I had to stand in front of a lot of people. And it was okay for me to stand in front of those people and say the things that I said. But yet in this other environment, it was the complete opposite. And someone shared with me, someone that I see as a mentor, she was like, when that larger group, those were your people. Like, they were your people. Even though you didn't know who they were, you were in a space in which those were your people. And so she encouraged me to find whatever it was that aided me in that, to aid me in some of these other circumstances. And I don't know, it's like this internal pre-work that you have to do sometimes when you know that you're going to be in front of whoever it may be. When you come to the table with naturally being intrinsic, not speaking, and, you know, like all of that, so that your working memory doesn't shut down. I think one person in my former job referred to it, or it was a PD session that I went to, is like that your amygdala gets hijacked. So that it could have been in the book too, that your amygdala is not hijacked. So with that though, because when we're different and we don't present in the way that others see us, sometimes it's not received well. Sometimes you're not perceived well. And so you mentioned having grace with yourself and bringing yourself back into a place where you can release the tension from your working memory. But how do you help others have grace with you?
That's not my job. And I think figuring that out. So the first 24 years of my life, I managed other people's reactions to me, actually way longer than the first 24 years of my life. I got really practiced at managing how people received me and how they felt about me. And this version of Josh, that's not his job. As an anecdote, one of my queer teachers that I'm like currently working with, just days ago came to me and said he's leaving the profession after 2 years of teaching, and that he feels he's too soft to be a teacher. And he felt like he and I shared a lot of characteristics. So he said, you know, like you, I'm silly and I'm funny. I'm compassionate. I'm nice. I'm empathetic. And my students walk all over me. Their parents walk all over me. And my colleagues walk all over me. And he says, I don't quite know how to keep doing this and not losing myself in the process. So he said, I'm stepping back. But he said, you are the same way, except, and these are his words, I would not use these words to describe myself. But he said, whatever room you walk into, you are a diva. You do not change yourself for the room. The room needs to change for you if they want to accept you. And he said, somehow you figured this out, that you walk into the room, you are you, and it's their job to accept you. And so he was saying, like, you're not dimming your light for the room. The room dims when you leave. And then they know what they've lost by not giving you that grace, that compassion. And again, I do see, like, looking retrospectively at my career, I for sure was working very hard to have the reputation of the best teacher in the building. No one could, because of this queer identity, because of what people had told me about who I should be or how I should present myself, I needed to be above all of that. I couldn't let others find any flaws in my teaching and any of what I was doing. And now I realized, like, yeah, I can just show up as my whole self. I can be a powerful, authentic, unapologetic Josh. And I think there's a joy in that that's contagious, quite frankly. It's very freeing to see somebody be themselves openly. And it's rare. And when I see it, I'm like, oh, kindred spirit. Like, I get to be me too, you know? And so, not to gloss over and not to say, like, those moments aren't hard. And there are for sure spaces where I am, like, pushed out of the space, for sure. That's because they're not ready yet. Has nothing to do with Josh. But that took a long time for me to figure out, right? And me telling the second year teacher, I was like, I think you are making the right decision. You do need to step back. You do need to protect yourself. And you do need to, I think it took a lot of me figuring out who Josh needed to be as a man in the world and as a teacher for queer students. You know, like my focus really, if you help queer students, you're going to end up helping everyone. So I don't really think about the others. But I think like figuring out who I needed to be as a queer teacher and as a queer man allowed me to become like the teacher I wanted and needed to become, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you, Josh, so much for all of your insights today. Gosh, there was just so much. And like I mentioned earlier, Karen and I, both we learned so much from having all of our guests on in the podcast this year. So as we wrap up, we ask all of our guests, can you give us one tip that leaders can do to support a sense of belonging in mathematics that's connected to the work you've done?
Yeah, I would, the two things. One, all leaders could use some intentional, protected time for themselves to start to understand when they are reacting and when they are responding, and modeling that for others. I think that's just like a life changer to begin with. And then I would say the other thing is create spaces, affinity type spaces, where queer teachers, any targeted group, teachers can find camaraderie and joy together. And I think, again, that joy becomes contagious. And I think that is worth creating. And I think it creates positive change.
There are so many things that you have left me to think about that are just resonating with me. I may reach out to you afterwards.
I mean, I hope we do. And I am just so, I feel so privileged and grateful to be included in this. This is you. I'm thankful that you've created this space for the guests that you've had on. I've enjoyed eavesdropping in on those conversations. And it's just so wonderful. So thank you for creating a space. It's very important and wonderful.
We absolutely loved having you here today. And thank you for being here. But how can our listeners learn a little bit more about you and your work? How can they find you?
The easiest place is to go to knowlesteacherinitiative.org. There's a lot of information about our fellowship, about our academy courses, about the work I do. There's some of my mindfulness presentations are there. Some of the resources I've done on this are there. So yeah, you can search me on that website, and all those resources, all those courses, all those workshops, everything we have on our site is free.
Nice. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you everybody for listening. We hope that you will listen next month to another podcast. Thank you everybody for being here.
We hope that you have been inspired by this bold mathematics leadership conversation and will tune in to our podcast series each month. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others, post about it on social media, or leave a rating and review. You can learn more about NCSM leadership and mathematics education and our upcoming professional learning events on the NCSM website, mathedleadership.com. You can also follow NCSM on the X at MathEdLeaders and using the hashtag NCSMBold. Until next time.